There's no better place to bird than in your own backyard. It's close and familiar, and you don't have to go far.
Thank you for tuning in to Hannah and Eric Go Birding, a podcast by birders for birders.
I'm Hannah, and he's Eric.
And we created this podcast to share our adventures, sometimes misadventures, and opinions that we have about different birding topics. We are definitely not experts, and anything that we discuss that might be controversial, we want you to remember, they're our own opinions, and they might be different from yours.
And I know we don't have a camera going on us, but every time I sing the little intro, we both just, like, laugh to ourselves.
I think you can kind of hear it in the audio. There's a little bit of a snicker, so it's... Hannah makes
You're
fun
rude.
Of me. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing because they're like creative.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I usually laugh at artwork.
Yeah, I mean, you see the Mona Lisa. you bust up every time you see these things.
You have weird reactions to things. So since our last episode, just a ton has happened.
Since we last met our birders.
Good one. including that the U.S. inaugurated a new president. So now we have Biden-Harris administration, which, you know, is our first presidential inauguration since we started this show. So
yeah, we haven't been doing our show through
that long.
Yeah, so yeah, our first transition of power.
So we're cautiously optimistic about what that means for environmental regulation and protection for wildlife. And, you know, we are always kind of afraid of being, like, Amerocentric. Well, USA-centric. Because
yeah.
We know we do have listeners outside of the U.S. But I think a lot of the you know, politics...
A lot of large-scale U.S. politics affects most of the world.
Well, and it also...
A lot.
It also affects birds.
Yeah,
and, you know,
sure.
A lot of people come from out of country into the U.S. to go birding. So those changes that happen might impact the way you bird here.
Yeah.
So that's happened.
Yeah, so that's a change here for us.
Yep.
And then also recently, paper was published. This is unrelated to politics.
There's been a lot of really interesting papers that came out in the last couple days even.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was one that we have talked about the topic of a couple times, and we actually talked last year at the, no, 2019, at the Willamette Bird Symposium. Was it 2020?
Yeah, the Willamette Bird Symposium. Yeah. One of the presenters, and we actually talked to the presenter a little bit afterwards, mm-hmm. Because he was talking about the Patagonia picnic table effect, and looking at that further as to how it relates to rarities, whether it's, you know, actual or whether it's myth. And so they came out with the paper finally.
Yeah, it was published like 5 days ago, like at the beginning of this week, I think.
And we'll include it in the show notes if you want to check it out. It's called The Influence of Rare Birds on Observer Effort and Subsequent Rarity Discovery in the American Birdwatching Community.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. There has been quite a debate online about some of the protocols that they used for gathering the data. But all in all, I thought it was really interesting, and it gets people kind of down the mindset of, if we're going to talk about this, the Patagonia picnic table effect as a thing, can we nail it down scientifically to prove it?
Mm-hmm.
And while this may not, his methodology, people may disagree with the way they, this group put together the data, like how they collected it and all that stuff, it's... At least it opens up the door for, hey, you can use, and they used eBird data for this, you can mm-hmm. use eBird data to test weird things like this that are not necessarily like distribution ranges of different things.
That's the cool thing about this is, like you said, it opens up all the different uses that you can have for eBird data.
Yeah.
So it's not just like, is a bird present here or is it absent or how is its range shifted, but you can look at birders themselves mm-hmm. and see how their actions
yeah you
changing.
Can see birder behavior in the eBird data. So they
did I okay that when I made my account?
I assume it's all anonymous data.
I know, I'm just kidding.
But anyways, some of the problems that people have pointed out, which aren't, they're not like huge problems. If you think it's a problem, then maybe you should do a study and
dispute it
and use your different methodology and say how your methodology is better than whatever they used. But
there's a challenge.
Yeah, there's a challenge. Do better methodology. Yeah. But the main thing was that they did not count code 3 birds as part of rarities, even though locally a specific code 3s would be really rare. And so the results could have been skewed, we don't know because we didn't do the study. I didn't go through and look up any data, and I haven't seen anyone online yet that has done that.
Well, it's not necessarily like skewed. It's just that they didn't look at, they looked at code 5 and code 4
yeah.
birds, and so that was the focus of their study. Mm-hmm. So if you did look at code 3, then that would completely change what the study is.
That's true.
It so it's not that it's skewed necessarily. It's just that it would be looking at a different thing.
Yeah. So the study focused on continentally rare birds. So code 4s and 5s. So it was really interesting to actually now we have the physical paper not in hand but virtually in hand virtually in hand. So now we can look at it, and now everyone can what is it, armchair scientists, these people?
Yeah.
they can sit back in their armchairs, and they can talk about how they should have done this or they should have done that. But it's really exciting that now it's out there, so we can all benefit from the fact that they've proven that you can use eBird data for things other than just abundance records and occurrence.
And so birds. If you submitted eBird records, your sightings could have been part of that, which I think is really cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Community science. So we did have a Facebook recommendation since our last episode. Would you like to do the honors?
Yeah. So a Facebook recommendation is from Lisa. She says, it's informative and fun. Highly recommend, especially while driving to Lifers. They brought me a lot of luck.
Well, we're so happy we brought you luck, Lisa. Thank you so much for your recommendation. And as always, we appreciate everyone who has submitted reviews of our show or mm-hmm. sent us emails even. Sometimes, you know, we feel like we're talking out in the void, but we appreciate it when you send us an email. So we had some people listen mm-hmm. to our show.
A couple people last time.
And actually, you know, Westlake Stevens wasn't in the top two.
Woo!
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think those IP addresses are getting assigned out there.
Good job, internet. So the top listenership was from Centennial, Colorado. And then second up was Seattle, Washington.
Yeah, so our neighbor to the north. Not that far north, but norther of us.
In Colorado, where we need to go birding.
We do need to go birding in Colorado.
Well, thank you all for listening to our show. And as always, if you have a weird town name, go ahead and get everyone in your town to listen, so then I have to pronounce it poorly. I think I did Centennial right, though.
Yeah, you might have done Seattle right, too.
You think
we'll
so?
See. We'll see if we get some hate mail on that one.
So, I am so excited to bring you guys this episode, because we had a handful of people on Instagram a couple months back. I posted, like, what would you like bird podcasts to talk about? Because we talk about what we want to talk about.
Yeah. And we talk about like things that we think of, like, oh, well, we should talk to this person, or we should go out and do this one thing. But it's just us thinking of what we want to do.
Yeah. And so we're always curious what you guys would like to hear about. And so I posted that, and I had a number of people respond back that they were interested in learning more about backyard birding. So that and the Great Backyard Bird Count is coming up, so we thought this would be a great opportunity to learn more about what it is to backyard bird and how to go about doing it.
Yeah, so we contacted Darlene from the Backyard Bird Shop, which she's the outreach coordinator there with the Backyard Bird Shop, and it's a local chain of bird supply stores. They carry all sorts of bird supply stuff for wild birds. So you've got feeders, seed, different garden decor, literature, field guides, all sorts of just stuff anything that you'd want for your backyard bird needs.
And there's a variety of different places you can go throughout the U.S. I'm sure worldwide there are other bird shops. I've never been to one.
I'm sure there are. I mean, I'm sure it's gotta be.
But like sometimes you can find this stuff that she'll talk about, like at botanical gardens, Audubon's, other bird clubs like Bird Life International, if they have any like stores. Sometimes like national parks will have this kind of gear too.
And honestly, a lot of big box stores will have a lot of the stuff. It may not be the same like specific niche, like very small locally made stuff, but you're still going to get a lot of stuff at big box stores too.
And we like the Backyard Bird Shop because it's our local location. Mm-hmm. I think there's a handful of them throughout the Portland metro area, but they also do really cool things like offering walks and classes for, you know, people in their area.
Yeah. So they provide not only the stuff you want, but they can provide you education and like experience in the field with how to deal with this. And the people are always so helpful at any of these stores, no matter where we've been to any store like this around the country. They've always been so helpful. You go in there and all they want to do is talk to you and tell you all about their yard and what you should be doing for your yard and how you can make your yard better.
We went to the Wild Birds Unlimited in Tallahassee when we were mm-hmm. living there. And we were trying to we wanted to put a feeder like on a hook outside of our patio, and we couldn't figure out how to like attach it to the banister on the patio.
Yeah.
And so we went to the Wild Birds Unlimited in that in Tallahassee, and oh my gosh, the person was just so helpful, and they were like, "Do you want me to order stuff for you?" And just on, and like, I mean, every wild bird store that I've been to has been the same experience. Oh, just yeah. Super helpful people that want you to be successful.
Yeah, and so we interviewed Darlene from the Backyard Bird Shop here locally near us, and she was no different than anyone else that we've talked to that work at these stores that are so helpful and so knowledgeable and just want to spread the word about birds and how you can just view birds in your backyard and how to help make that better for yourself and make it easier for you to see them.
So we'll quit.
Yes. Anyways,
going on about that and let you enjoy our chat with Darlene. Awesome. Thank you, Darlene, so much for joining us for this podcast. Would you please tell us about yourself?
Sure. So I enjoy being around people, getting out in nature, making our yard a sanctuary for the birds, working on creative projects, and eating delicious foods. And here's your warning. I love talking about birds. So in non-COVID times, I would enjoy traveling and birding around Oregon, around the U.S. and other countries with my husband. And it's to experience and learn more about the natural world. We just love doing that. Birds have been a part of my life for about 40 years, even more than that. I started at age 12 when my sister's feeder was piling in with evening grosbeaks. And those birds are such a wow. I noticed it immediately and I was hooked. I wound up studying birds in college and getting my degree in biology, but focused on ornithology. And then I did field work for a while and did that in Oregon and Washington. And then I took a position with Portland Audubon, where I was working with people instead of birds on behalf of birds. And I'm a people person. So I found that to be even more gratifying because I was getting to a point where I didn't want to go birding on my weekends. And so now the past 17 years, I've been part of Backyard Bird Shop's flock. And I've enjoyed connecting people to nature as I work with customers and write articles for newsletters and social media postings. So that's pretty much me.
So where's your favorite place that you've ever been birding?
Oh, that's so hard. You know, it really is. It's funny because people used to ask me what my favorite bird was and I'd say whichever one I was looking at. So it's almost like wherever I'm birding at. But I will say I love Australia.
We need to get down there so bad.
Yeah.
We keep hearing so much good stuff about Australia.
Oh, Australia just has such a different world. It's really incredible. But then there's places in the U.S. that I absolutely love. Arizona, if you're going to talk about the U.S., I know you guys mentioned Arizona before, because I heard one of your podcasts that you sent. And gosh, Arizona is just a fabulous place to go birding.
There's so many good places to go.
There are.
But we asked you here to talk about birding in your backyard. So what is backyard birding and how is that different from other types of birding?
So there's actually a lot of overlap, but backyard birding is generally more passive in that you're spending time in one place watching whatever birds come along and then in a spontaneous way throughout the day. Unlike the other birding, where backyard birding doesn't require packing up gear, getting dressed for the weather, making travel plans for destinations, looking for birds, that kind of thing. Backyard birding usually involves making your outdoor space inviting to the birds with feeders, bird baths, bird houses, and naturescaping with plants, right? Because you're going to try and draw in as much as you can. So that's kind of the difference, but really it's all about looking at birds. It's just in different ways.
Yeah. So is backyard birding a way that people like more commonly people get into birding, or is it kind of a beginning stepping stone for birding maybe?
It can be for some, but honestly, there's no one way that people get started with birding.
Mm-hmm.
I started because of my sister's feeder. So that was backyard birding. But then when I went to college, I found some of the students had never been exposed to that. And all of a sudden in our ornithology class, they got hooked on our birding when we were doing birding field trips. And they had never, you know, done any feeders or anything. So what I do find, however, is that one leads to the other as well. They eventually nurture each other.
So what do you need to be a backyard birder?
Well, birds to watch. That's the most important thing. But of course, you know, you want your outdoor space to be naturally inviting. But if it's not, then installing feeders. And there's a lot of different kinds. Bird baths, bird houses, as well as working on creating birdie habitat helps invite a greater variety of birds to your outdoor space. And so I say outdoor space because not everybody has a yard. It could be a patio. It could be, you know, we have people from Backyard Bird Shop customers who are feeding hummingbirds on the 21st floor of a condo downtown.
Right? So that's a good point. You don't need an expansive 30-acre backyard to be able to backyard bird.
Nope, you don't. And then we have people that have patios and they naturescape in planters and have feeders and bird baths. And those are lovely little refuges for the birds among the cement.
Yeah, right. That's a good point, because we have a lot of friends that, you know, they love having like a nice green yard, like that's coveted, you know, among some people. And so there's ways to have both, right? Like you can, like you said, naturescape your patio, but still have your green yard.
Yeah. I lived in North Portland for a while, and my backyard was literally a cement patio, and I just brought in all kinds of plants. And it was amazing. Of course, I was looking over the Willamette River, and having a river out in the distance from your backyard really brings in a lot of birds. But bringing them in close were the plants and the trees and the shrubs and things that I grew on the cement patio.
So really anything that you can see from your house is your backyard, right?
Really? Yeah, that really is. Right. So it might be your neighbor's backyard. And some people, you know, they don't even feel like they need to add much to their yard because they are looking out on a natural green space that is very birdy. But of course, usually once you notice the birds, then you're like, oh, I'd like to bring them even closer. And then there's window feeders. And that's why the people on the 21st floor, right, they can feed with window feeders. And for a while I lived in Northwest Portland downtown. And I was on the fourth floor, and I had seed feeders, suet feeders, and all I had was a big cherry tree out my window on the fourth floor. And I am telling you, I had birds downtown there. It was amazing. People just wouldn't have thought of it. So you can do a lot.
So what sort of things can you do to encourage a higher diversity as opposed to just seeing just starlings?
Oh, for sure. Or even just seeing the same chickadee or whatever, right? Yeah. So with diversity, it's a matter of, there's three main things that birds need. They need food, shelter, and water. And so depending on offer, you can start to increase what you attract as far as the number of species. And so with food, there's birds have different diets and different ways that they like to eat food. Let's say you have a tube feeder and you fill it with sunflower. Well, chickadees, nuthatches, goldfinches, a lot of these perching birds are going to come in and use that. But that same seed, if you put it into a tray feeder, would also attract song sparrows, bowies, juncos. And so you can bring in additional birds by even feeding the same seed in a different kind of feeder.
Hmm.
Right? And so ground feeding birds are much more comfortable feeding from what we call a table. You know, they're on a spread table is what they're eating from at ground. Doesn't mean they have to eat at ground level. I feed ground feeding birds here at our home on the second story with a tray feeder right outside our second story window. And they come right up, but it's like elevated ground. And if you think about places, landscapes don't always have ground at the same level. So juncos would be working along a cliffside and they're going to be feeding all over, right? Mm-hmm. And I had buried thrush right up next to the window on a tray feeder. So there's all kinds of options for adding new birds coming in. In addition to the different kinds of feeders, then there's different kinds of seed. Now, if you seed, only one seed, black oil sunflower is going to be your most important one. It will draw the most variety of birds in of any seed that you can find for birds, right? It has high fat, high protein, and a super soft shell. So even your tiny seed eaters can open that and get to that really good snack. Other things, you can get sunflower that is out of the shell, and that can draw in a few more birds who don't have a bill for even, they weren't meant to be opening bills, you know, or opening shells. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like doves will often sit below us black oil sunflower, waiting for little bits and pieces to come, and they'll eat the bits and pieces. But if you happen to have bits and pieces already available by having some shelled, they'll readily come for that. Same with the buried thrush. So buried thrush would readily take the heart of sunflower, but it doesn't have the capability of opening it. In addition, there's seeds like white proso millet, cracked corn. These are all attractive to ground feeding birds. Niger thistle is something that are for the goldfinches. The goldfinches do love it, and you can put it in a feeder. And then what that allows is they're small birds. They don't have to compete with larger birds against that seed because nobody else can get that out of the feeder. Just them. They have the bill for doing it. So that gains more diversity at one time where you don't have being pushed off the feeder by a jay or a house finch or something else that's larger. Then just pop in if you have any questions as I chat about this, right?
No, you're good. Yeah. So I was just thinking you've already listed like 15 species with just having two different types of feeders and three different types of seed.
Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't even begun because, okay. I do want to say this about a lot of people go, well, I know I'll just get a variety by putting a seed mix in a tube feeder. But again, you're missing certain birds that don't like to come and perch at a mm-hmm. feeder. So a mix actually is better on a tray feeder. Because what happens is when you have a tube feeder, the birds tend to come in and sort through the seed with their bills. They flick it. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon you have a mountain below that's been sorted out while they're trying to find their favorite seed, which is usually black oil. So better to put it on a tray where the bird can come and pick what their seed is. And then others who don't mind the other stuff will come and eat the other things. That said, watch for mixes that have either Milo or red millet in them. These are inexpensive filler seeds, and our birds really don't like them here in the Pacific Northwest. So it just ends up being left behind and it's a waste.
So what's the pickiest bird?
Ha, they're all picky. Picky. What's the pickiest bird? Well, I would think that some of your, and I wouldn't even think of it as picky, but I'm going to say that my ornithology instructor, Dr. Forbes at PSU, used to say there are birds that are like crowbars when it comes to being a tool for finding food. And then there are birds who are like a micrometer. They just have such a finite little niche of what they can do for food. And so that becomes more of a challenge with those kinds. So when I think of that kind of bird, I think of our swifts, mm-hmm. right? I think yeah. of swallows. You know, they don't come to feeders.
Yeah.
And so that, whereas if I think of a crow, right? They can eat people food. They can eat pet food. They can eat birds, mammals, snakes, roadkill. You know, they have all kinds of food available to them. So they're not as picky.
So speaking of crows, I had someone send me this question that, you know, in Portland, there's a huge influx of crows and people are upset about that. But, you know, across the country and across the world, there's different nuisance birds that you might have coming to your feeders or in your yards. Like I know in Texas, cowbirds were a big deal. How do you manage for things like that? And also like rodents around your feeders?
Sure. Well, when it comes to, first off, I want to say what is a nuisance to one is not a nuisance to everyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so out of respect to folks who love feeding the crows, I just want to recognize that some people get a lot of pleasure and enjoy feeding the crows while others are like, no, thanks. Now, I personally do not want to encourage the crows because they do have so many other options and their numbers are outnumbering our other smaller birds. And of course, the more there are, the more likely they can shop our smaller birds nest, right?
Yeah.
And so
they're fun to watch,
though. To encourage them. What's that?
The crows are fun to watch. They have so much personality.
They are absolutely fun to watch. I would never. And the other thing I want to say is that when we say nuisance birds, we have to be careful too, in that some of these quote unquote pests are actually protected by federal law. So the crows are native. The cowbirds are native. These are all birds that are protected. You cannot harm them, nor their mess with their nests, their eggs, their feathers, any of that, right? And so, whereas the non-natives, such as the starling or the house sparrow, those guys are not protected. And many people do try to discourage them, but I've also had people who, I had one woman who came in and she said, what do starlings like to eat? And she had adopted one that was a fledgling and later told me how this bird really bonded with her, would sit on her shoulder and watch TV with her and nibble on her ear. And I mean, was just a very precious bird to her. And I thought, you know, we should all own a starling. they are really fascinating birds. So anyway, as to how to discourage some of these birds, you can do that. Particularly, let's talk first about crows. Crows are large. And so they need, if they're going to come in and feed, they need a place where they can land and reach the food. So if you place it, if you have a small feeder, let's say it's a hopper feeder, which is the house style, right? And even some of the tube feeders can be difficult for them to get to because they have short perches, because they've got to get their feet in there and they have to have the rest place for it. And they need to be able to move their head down to find the food. So unless they're off on a side branch, grabbing the food from a side branch, that lets you know, place it so that they don't have a side branch for landing and accessing the food. I've learned to put a baffle over my suet feeder. I have pileated woodpeckers coming in feeding. And at first I let the crows have some too. I thought, well, I can get suet. It's not a problem. But then one day I saw them quietly chasing my pileated away as if to say territorial. And I went, okay, you're done. And so I put a baffle over it because what they were doing was landing on top of the feeder, leaning over and eating the suet. Once I have the baffle and it's up inside it, they cannot lean on, they can't land on it anymore and lean over, and they have a hard time fluttering. I've had one on occasion try to come in and flutter and take. Just depends on how desperate they are, but you can really minimize what they get to. And so by having smaller feeders that won't accommodate them or using baffles to keep them from accessing the food is one way to take care of that. And then when it comes to starlings, some people use upside down suet feeders to thwart them. And some people are very successful with that. Others say, nope, my starlings learned how to cling and they just hang on with one foot and just feed away. So we also have cage within a cage is what it's called, where it's supposed to be squirrel proof, but it also ends up discouraging starlings. And then depending on the width of that cage, it can really be starling proof where they cannot reach in at all. Some of them, they can reach in for a while, but as the cage gets smaller on the suet, it becomes difficult for them and they can't take over like they usually do. And they're such flock feeders that if one is the only one eating or a couple and everybody else is upset, off they go. And then the rest want to leave to be with the flock. So that helps. Cowbirds. We don't tend to have that much trouble with them here with food. I'm not sure how to respond to that on the food, but I will say, you know, again, they're a native bird. And the main thing for us is that, you know, they go and they lay eggs in other birds' nests. But since they're protected, there's nothing we can do. That's just part of nature. It's part of the regular web. So.
When I was working in Texas, I worked at a park that had feeders up down in southern Texas, and we had such an influx of cowbirds that would come each summer that we would take the feeders down because they would overwhelm them, and then they would I think they actually parasitize green jay nests, and that was one of the purposes for that. And in Texas, you know, they do have permits, so you can take of cowbirds. But like you said, it's not such a big issue here in the Pacific Northwest, fortunately.
And in fact, that is true to say that if there is an issue, then you have to apply for a permit to be able to take some of those birds. And when we say take, that means making it so that they removed from the ecosystem. They do not exist anymore. Yeah. Uses them out. And so, and definitely there are permits for that, but you have to have a permit. Otherwise you are in doing a federal crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, and then when it came to squirrels, rodents, that kind of thing, or other, again, you can do pole baffles. Pole baffles are quite effective from keeping squirrels. A lot of people think, oh, I'm going to buy this shepherd's hook and hang my feeder on that because then the squirrels won't get to it. But squirrels can shimmy right up those, no trouble. And actually rats can too. Portland has quite a rat situation, right? And so rats at night will shimmy up as well and take advantage of any kind of food source, which you really don't want to do. And so putting a baffle on a pole or on a shepherd's hook will keep them from climbing. And you usually need to have that baffle at least 3 to 4 feet above ground so they don't jump over it. Mm-hmm. And once they climb up, they get to that point and they can't reach over the baffle to get keep going. Now, baffles are only good if they cannot jump from the sides. You're wasting your time if you're putting a baffle because you're closing one highway, but the other highway is wide open. And so always keep in mind that before you buy a baffle, take a look around, decide whether or not the squirrel would begin to jump from another access point as to whether that's helpful. If you cannot get them by baffling them, and I should also mention there's hanging baffles. So people that have their feeder hanging from a limb on a tree can put a hanging baffle over it. And you have to make sure that it's going to be appropriate because if you push on that baffle and you can see any part of the feeder, it just becomes a slide to the feeder. So you always have to kind of test, make sure that that baffle really covers your feeder. And that'll stop them from coming from the top down. So we can stop them top down, bottom up. But what we can't do is stop them from jumping from the sides. And so if they're jumping from the sides, now what we have to look at is a squirrel-proof feeder that has a cage within a cage or type of thing, or a weight-driven one that closes on them when they get on it. But the birds have hollow bones, super light, they don't close it. Even the largest bird won't close it, right? And if that isn't something you want to do, one of the other things you can do is use habanero oil-infused sunflower hearts. That's called hot meat. They're very spicy. And birds do not respond to them like mammals. Mammals do not like them. And it really does keep away. I do use them on my tray feeders because otherwise I'd be overrun with squirrels. I live in a woodland setting and it works very effectively. And then I can enjoy seeing buried thrush and towhees and other birds coming up to enjoy them.
Yeah, we've used the suet cakes with the chili in it. And yes. Oh my gosh, we've seen squirrels run for water and that's,
yeah,
it's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't harm them. That's one thing I do want to point out because, you know, there's a lot of squirrel lovers and I actually do like my squirrels, but I don't want them eating my birdseed.
Sure.
I'm one of those control freaks. I want my squirrels over here and my birds over there and enjoy them all. But okay, everybody keep to your place. So anyway, that's also an alternative and it ends up being a nice alternative for many people because then you get to feed who you want to feed. So, but I do want to still talk a little bit about bringing in more diversity. Because we just talked on some of the food or the seed, I should say. And there's a lot of other kinds of feeders that you can add to bring diversity. So adding a suet feeder, we talked about keeping birds off of suet feeders. But first off, there's maybe people who don't even know what suet is. Suet is rendered beef fat, and often it has additives like sunflower seeds or insects, peanut butter, peanut hearts, that kind of stuff, to provide a high fat, high protein source to a lot of insect eating birds. So you have some birds that do both insects and seed. That would be like a chickadee. They'll visit your suet feeder, they'll visit your seed feeder. But then there are birds that really don't want seed. They're looking for insects and they've learned to go to suet. And so suet can add things like kinglets. Your ruby-crowned kinglets will come into suet. You'll have Townsend's warblers, yellow rump warblers. This is, you know, during winter time when there's scarcity. And then you also have, I think who else that I haven't mentioned that'll come in. Oh, well, all your woodpeckers, right?
Oh, yeah.
And let's see. Anyways, I can't imagine my life without suet. because it brings in such beautiful birds. And nowadays, it used to be that suet only came in a small kind of block. But nowadays, you can get suet in logs. You can get them in little nuggets. And berry thrush love the nuggets. They will readily take that up. And I should say that a lot of times people don't realize berry thrush and other birds like towhees would love nuts, peanuts out of the shell. And of course, your jays and your crows love peanuts in the shell, or filberts out of the shell, that type of thing. So anything that's high fat, high protein is really a source that the birds love. In addition to suet, if you really want to have fun, live mealworms. Oh, man. So I have to tell you, I've been feeding live mealworms the past 3 years. And I've bonded with individual birds over live mealworms, which I never thought I could do. It never even occurred to me until it happened. And the first was a song sparrow that we wound up naming Camellia. And it was a male because he was a singer. And he would learn to perch in our camellia tree outside our kitchen window because we would toss live mealworms out that window on the ground. And so he learned we were the source, and he would jump up in the camellia to say, "Hey, we're out of mealworms." And so, of course, we would reward him and throw some more manna out. And he got to the point that he recognized me as the food source. And I thought it was just the window, except that when I would be out working in the yard, all of a sudden, I'd be in the backyard, our windows in the front yard. He'd show up and he'd do this little dance like, "Well, got mealworms?" And of course I'd go in and oblige. So he disappeared after nesting season. And then lo and behold, the next spring shows up again, looking in the window. My husband says, "Hey, you've got your song sparrow looking in the window again." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, it's Camellia." So back to our routine again. Now we have a towhee that discovers what we're doing. And the towhee gets so brazen that if we didn't acknowledge him at the perch in the camellia, he would flutter against the window get our attention. And it's like, wow, this guy is really bold. So I quickly took a branch, put two holes in a plastic tub lid and attached it. And I created a wand feeder that I would hold out the window. And he would perch on the other side, come in and grab the mealworms off of it.
Oh, wow.
And then after he did that a number of times, a pair of chickadees realized what I was doing and they started using the wand feeder. So we did this all last spring during COVID. It was such a joy. And guess what? My chickadees are back. As of this week, I've been feeding them with the wand feeder again. But I also have a live mealworm feeder that they come and visit regularly. So live mealworms are huge, and especially during baby bird season. When we have cold snaps, insects are scarce, and a lot of birds do not feed their young seed. Actually, the only ones that feed their young seed are the finch family. They're the exception. They're truly seed eaters, and they will give their young digested seed, partially digested seed, whereas chickadees don't take seed to their young. Nuthatches don't do that either. Everybody's looking, juncos, they're all looking for bugs. And so to take mealworms, the towhee would look like the puffin do with fish. He'd have so many mealworms in his mouth hanging and off he'd go to feed his young. So it's really popular during nesting season. And a lot of people think it's mealworms are just for bluebirds. But let me tell you, I've had, when I put them in a little dish inside my squirrel-proof suet feeder, the downy woodpecker discovered them. And he started doing the same thing like the puffin do with the fish. Wow. It's amazing how many birds will take them. So that's one way to gain a lot of activity too. Of course, we've got nectar feeders for hummingbirds. And depending on where you live, you may get orioles, right, as well. Mm-hmm. And then there's fruit feeders with orange halves, a lot of, like down in Malheur, they've got the oranges out for the birds. And the, grosbeaks are coming into it. Tanagers are coming into it. Orioles are coming into it. House finches are coming into it. And then for folks who live around mockingbirds love coming in for apples on a fruit feeder. So there's all kinds of fun things that you can do. Belly feeders can attract orioles and house finches as well. And my newest feeder is a fruit fly incubating feeder for the hummingbirds. And what I do is I take my banana peels and any of the brown parts of the banana, I put in that fruit feeder, cover it, and it incubates, it attracts fruit flies to nest and breed. And then as they emerge, the birds will come and take them as they emerge. And I discovered not just the hummingbirds using it, but bush tits also. So really fun.
Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a new one for us. And it's really fun. At first I thought, I don't know if this is going to work. Then I wound up seeing a video online about it. And I'm like, oh man, got to have it. And the thing is, I had realized ahead of time that I had in cold weather, I had warblers and hummingbirds both visiting my black compost bin where the cracks are on the side because it's warmer in there and that's where bugs are coming out. After a frost in the fall, I would lift the lid of my compost bin and the hummingbird would come in and snag the bugs as they came out.
Wow.
So it's just taking advantage of that. Really fun. Now, of course, one other thing that you can do, which is huge, is naturescaping. You know, if you have the outdoor space to do it, whether it's in planters on a patio or it's actually in a yard, and putting in native plants, shrubs, and trees will go a long way toward attracting diversity. Last year, we had an orange-crowned warbler and a black-throated gray warbler come down from the tree canopy to visit a newly planted native rose to take and forage on the foliage. And one was one day and then one was the next day. And we were just like, wow, we just put that in fall. How did they find that? And it was right between two cultivars, right? They did not go to the cultivars at all. They went straight for that native plant. And then the other thing we've seen is we have hermit thrush eating huckleberries from our evergreen huckleberry plants. We've watched the song sparrow jump up to nab seeds off of our yellow wood violets. It's just really rewarding to see them taking natural food, and native plants are going to provide that the best. You don't always have to have completely all native plants. And one thing I want to mention is that Portland Audubon, for people in the Portland area, they have a backyard certification program that helps you plan your plantings. And then it provides you with the opportunity to purchase native plants at a discount for certifying your yard. And so you don't have to have all natives. They certify at three different levels. But it's an exciting thing to have birds coming in and taking advantage of the plants that you pick for them. So, water. Any questions on the plants or anything?
No, native plants are fantastic.
I warned you that I like talking about birds and stuff, right? Okay. Water. Water is a big draw because all birds need water. And they need a fresh source for drinking as well as for bathing. Without bathing, they're not going to keep their feathers in the top shape. And that is important for their survival. So with all the feeders that I've mentioned, there are still some species you can gain by adding water that will not come to any of those feeders that I talked about. And this includes, now we have a dripper bird bath, and it is our most popular. So a dripper is something that you hook up your spigot. It doesn't require electricity. And it will, you can control the rate, but it does this drip, drip, drip. And that mimics a natural spring, and a natural spring is fresh. And the same is true if you have a fountain. It mimics the sound of moving water in a creek or in a stream, right? Hmm. And moving water is always more fresh than still water. And so birds are attracted, and they are very auditory. You know, they sing, they listen for sound. And so they hear water, they will come in. And so here are some of the birds that we've had at our dripper bath that we do not get at any kind of feeders. Robins, cedar waxwings, golden crown kinglets, warbling and Hutton's vireos, Wilson's warblers, black-throated gray warblers, brown creepers. These are wonderful birds to see. Oh, yeah. And you'd be missing it if you didn't have water. So adding a bubbler or a fountain always makes it even more attractive than just a still bath, but even with a still bath, you can bring in birds as long as you're keeping that water fresh, refresh it regularly. Shelter is the other thing that I said that all birds need. And so depending on the space that you have, again, whether, and by the way, birds don't recognize property lines. So whether they think your patio is part of the neighbor's yard or not, doesn't matter. You can put up a birdhouse on your patio, and they could potentially be using it. I've had birds nest on houses, birdhouses that I've set right on my exterior wall. And so It doesn't require having a yard. And then there's also nesting shelves. So you can add birdhouses, nesting shelves, roosting pockets. All these can provide either nesting or roosting sites for birds. And then offering natural nesting material is super fun. A lot of our urban yards don't have necessarily great nesting material available for everyone. And so they have to do with whatever they find. Nature will continue, but it might not be ideal. And so if you can offer them either pet fur makes a wonderful one for many. The chickadees love it. Plant down. And then there's also coconut fibers for jays. They love those. A lot of people complain that they start pulling apart their coconut fiber planters. dried grasses and leaves, feathers, mud. Mud is important for robins and for Steller's jays. And so, and little twigs and things, leaving some stuff around for them. But when I say creating a nesting station, right now we already have ours out because the first bird to start taking nesting material will be the Anna's hummingbird. And we already saw her this weekend picking at it, but she wasn't serious. She dropped it. And so I was surprised to see her doing it this early, but I usually have it out by middle of January to advertise. And then within 2 weeks, by February 4th or 5th, I can mark it on my calendar. Every year I have somebody taking nesting material and it's an Anna's hummingbird. And they will continue to nest all the way through June. But later on, chickadees, bushtits, all kinds of birds will come in for nesting material. And if you don't have, so when we're talking bushtits and we're talking Annas, they make cup nests. And so they lay their eggs. Well, an Anna has white eggs. And so it does not want dark pet fur. So your black cat hair would be great for chickadees, but not for the Annas. She wouldn't even be taking it. She wants something light. So if you have a light colored pet, you could put that into a clean suet cage, or you can put it into an old hairbrush that you no longer use and hang it outside. They really love taking it from a hairbrush. So these are some things you can do. And if you don't have that, well, then visit Backyard Bird Shop or a similar kind of store that will have nesting material stations that are ready to go and you can hang them. And I leave mine out from middle of January all the way through 4th of July. And I've had hummingbirds pull, like I said, regularly by February 4th or 5th. And the latest I've seen a hummingbird pull is June 14th. But nesting season goes for quite some time, and that's fun. And to have them, I put in a number of birdhouses. My brother-in-law teases and says, I think you have more square footage in birdhouses than in your own house. And I'm like, I'm okay with that. So offering all kinds, they don't always get moved into, but giving them options is fun. And we typically will have two or three families nesting with us each season. And that's lots of fun, a lot of activity. One other thing I want to mention is using branches. So if you don't have places to land, like when I had that patio, I wound up planting dead shrubs into some of my planters. And I'm sure the neighbors thought that poor woman thinks those things are going to grow. It was going to be purchased for my birds. And they, you know, it's like dormant season is what it's like. And they come in and they use those perches. But I've also taken and I've screwed branches into the sides of feeders, wood feeders. I've had a friend who showed us how he used branches, attaching it to his suet feeder. And that brought in more birds as well. Branches are a natural invite. We've been using branches at our bird baths for years. And we've had pileated woodpeckers come down a branch to use it. They're much more comfortable than just coming into a big open bird bath. And so if you can add some branches, that really bring in more diversity.
Well, awesome, man, you've given us so much great information to bring in different species and how to put out your yard, you know, to, or put out the for sale sign to the birds.
Yeah,
so
for rent. The,
yeah.
Yeah, for rent.
At a very low price.
So the Great Backyard Bird Count is coming up. And if someone isn't already a backyard birder, how, you know, it's like 3 weeks away or 2 weeks, what can they do to get prepared for that?
Get ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the main thing to do is to watch birds and practice noting things about them. Now, if you visit the website, though, it's also ideal that the sooner you visit that website and follow their instructions with what apps to download and how to get clued into their accounts and that. Everything is free. I just want to mention that. It is, there's no cost, and it's wonderful because it's something that contributes to citizen science. But practicing watching and noting things like what the bird size is, you know, is it a relative size? Is it bigger than a crow? Is it smaller than a crow? Is it bigger than a robin? Smaller than a robin? Well, they may not even know what a crow and robin are, right? I mean, we take some of that for granted. And so just trying to get an idea, you might think, well, is it bigger than a softball or is it bigger? And then later you can go and look up the size of certain birds. If you have an idea of what a softball or a soccer ball or whatever is, right? You can relate it to other things that you are familiar with. And then compare that size with what they say that size of the bird is. So the other thing is behavior. Where is the bird hanging out? What is it doing? Make note of that. Appearance. What's the bird's stance? You know, is it upright? What is it doing? Is it laying down? Is it, you know, all those kind of things. What about its colors and its markings? The shape and color of the bill or the legs, the tail, the eyes. There's a lot to see, and it's really fun because it takes some practice getting yourself to actually focus on it instead of just being wowed by the whole thing. And then later you're like, so what did you see? And I'm like, I don't know. It was a bird. It was really cool. Right.
Yeah.
And so really trying to teach yourself, pay attention to what it is you're seeing, being mindful of what you notice about that bird. So, and in addition, if you have those apps uploaded, practice using them beforehand, so you're not frustrated afterwards. And the other thing I want to mention, the Merlin app, which they recommend, is fabulous for new people when it comes to identifying birds. It asks you particular questions. And this is, again, where you want to try and pay attention to what you're seeing. So it'll ask you a number of questions, and then it'll give you some choices afterwards. It'll show you pictures of birds that might be what you saw. And I've tested them. You know, because I know my birds, I don't need the app, but I have tested them to see how that Merlin app works, and they have come a long way. It is really a great tool for new people. Now, you can also have a field guide, but a field guide can be awfully overwhelming for someone who's new, because first off, it's arranged in taxonomic order, which makes absolutely no sense to someone who's never studied birds. And there are some field guides that are arranged by color, but I kind of laugh at that because if you look at the brown section, it's almost the entire book. So good luck. You get to look through a lot of brown birds. But the Merlin app combined with a field guide would be great, because now you can go back and look at a field guide after using the Merlin app and helping you narrow down who it is. And then you can look up the bird in the index until you get to a point where you know where birds are within a field guide. So, and the other thing I want to say is that the Great Backyard Bird Count actually doesn't have to be in your backyard. It can be anywhere. And so if you don't have a backyard, but you'd like to be able to participate, you can participate with as little as a 15-minute commitment over the course of any day. And you don't have to participate all 4 days. But of course, you can participate much more than that too. So I do want to encourage people to consider contributing to that. It's really a wonderful thing.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for all this great information. I'm excited. We just bought a house, and so we're working on our backyard, and I put up the feeders today. So hopefully we'll get some stuff for the backyard bird count.
Fingers crossed.
That's great.
But now I feel like I need to diversify what we put out, because I just put like 2 tube feeders and 2 suet feeders because
that's already diversity right there. That's great.
We need a platform now though.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely a platform or a fly through is really fun. So for sure, it's all for the birds.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on.
So thank you so much, Darlene, for joining us. It was just an absolute pleasure. You are just a wealth of information, and we really appreciated you bringing your know-how to our show.
Oh, for sure. For somebody that it is their expertise to know about birds, bird feeders, and bird seeds, and all that stuff. Like she definitely has the knowledge.
Yeah. Like we were talking about, the Great Backyard Bird Count is coming up. It is February 12th through the 15th in 2021. In 2020, they had over 250,000 people participate that saw almost 7,000 species of birds identified across 194 countries.
That's so, like 70% of the bird species.
That's a lot.
And I mean, if you're thinking about North America and or North Hemisphere, South Hemisphere, That's a lot of birds. I'm just thinking it's winter now, but it's summer down south. So I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I was going somewhere, but it didn't land. I didn't make it that way.
Anyways, it's really easy to participate. You just need an eBird account, and mm-hmm. you have to bird between those days, so February 12th to the 15th, and you need to submit your data by March 1st. So you can do it on your phone, you can do it on your computer, but you just need to have that eBird account to submit this list.
Yeah, so there's no additional sign up, no additional check this box or that box or anything. Any of the data that's submitted to eBird for these time frames is counted.
So yeah, so get out and count those birds, and it's over Valentine's Day weekend, mm-hmm. so maybe you can go out and go on a date. And
A bird date.
I know we're going to be on one of those.
It's going to be nice.
So definitely check it out, participate, and help contribute to community science.
Yeah.
Just like the Patagonia picnic table effect. Maybe you'll find one.
We brought this right back around to the beginning.
Oh my gosh, this is the first time that we've circled back. I hope you're all as proud of us as I am.
Yeah, and so we'll leave you with that. So thank you all for listening to our podcast. We hope that you enjoyed it and or learned something new. Please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Music, Apple Watch, Alexa hat. I don't know. Anywhere else that you can.
What is an Alexa hat?
Anywhere that you can listen to us.
Hat. Turn up heat.
Just put on another hat. If you'd like to connect with us on the socials, please follow us at Hannah Goes Birding and Eric Goes Birding on Instagram.
Hannah with an H, Eric with a K.
You can follow our Facebook page, Hannah and Eric Go Birding. You can follow our Twitter at We Go Birding. You can email us at HannahandEricGoBirding@gmail.com. And you can also check out our website, www.gobirdingpodcast.com. And tell us what you like, tell us what you hated. Mostly tell us what you liked, but also share us with your friends.